Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two installments of our conversation with Penelope Leyland, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry events and news from the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Last week on Poetry on the Radio, Peter Searles, Peter Monahan, and I spoke with Canberra-based poet Penelope Leyland about her recent book, Beloved, which explores the ties between Dorothy Wordsworth and her famous poet brother, William. This week, we ask her more about that work, as well as her two other publications from Recent Work Press. Her prize-winning collection, Nye, from 2020, as well as her 2018 collection, Things I've Thought to Tell You Since I Saw You Last, which explored the nature of elegy. At the end of last week's discussion, Penelope Leyland was telling us about some of the difficult conditions of Dorothy Wordsworth's life, including her powerful emotional entanglement with William. As Dorothy grew older, she became infirm, and her pain at a growing distance from her brother deepened her gloom.
It was a historical fact, but surely one that had an incredible effect on people, that half the family died, young, old, in between.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, the loss of her mother really probably started that. And, you know, William and Mary, two of their children died, and Dorothy was deeply affected by that because, as I said, she'd lived with and helped bring up those children. And particularly in her letters, she writes a lot about her brother dying, the sea captain,
John,
and the children dying. Yeah, I think it was just a fact of life in those days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ill health. I mean, it was, people used to remark that both William and Dorothy always looked a lot older than they actually were. And part of that might have been because, unusually for people of their class and position in English society, they spend a lot of time out of doors walking around, and they wouldn't have necessarily had sun protection.
And then they lose their teeth.
Their teeth very early. And so, you know, they have that drawn-in look from the time they're possibly late 20s, early 30s.
I was going to just say something about William cannot abide what he calls my nervous blubbering, because I think that is a point where in the poems you realize that it is a very complex relationship, and it's kind of a push-shove relationship where they're close, but they're, you know, and siblings are that way.
Yeah, right? That's right.
There's no greater love, and there's also no one who can make you suffer more than a sibling.
Coleridge's marriage was very unhappy for most of the time, and he did confide in the Wordsworths about the unhappy state of his marriage. He was also, you know, a heavy laudanum user, and part of the reason they went to Scotland with him was to try and wean him off laudanum. And ironically, William later had to attempt to do the same with Dorothy. So this is around the time when it was clear that Coleridge's marriage was unsurvivable, I suppose. And he was writing to them, but the nervous blubbering in the first line is actually from her own writing. So it's, you know, it's words that she used about it. Coleridge in difficulty. William cannot abide what he calls my nervous blubbering. So I sit alone this night, small rubble of fire failing, and Coleridge's letter impressive as a hot coal in my hand. What might fate have held for our closed circle? Could our friends' steps have been retaken, and the worst of them forsaken? Has his anodyne not been first taken and then taken too? Had he mastered that welter of emotion, so deeply felt that it will test even the finest intentions? Had he met us earlier? discovered another heart closer vibrating to his wild one than the poor plain pulse of the wife I truly pity. Feeling even now, with his words hot in my hand, some small portion of her indignity. It is for the two, for their contempt, that I weep.
There's something else that I wanted to touch on, which maybe gives hints at their character and lifestyle, that of Dorothy, William and Coleridge, was that they moved home because their lease wasn't renewed and that there had been some suspicion about them from the neighbours. And I just wondered what you made of that from your research, what happened there.
Yes, they were living in a house that was lent to William by a friend, a house called Al Foxton. As I mentioned earlier, they spend a lot of time walking, reciting poems, dreaming, talking, and just being creative, being rather bohemian, really, for the time. It was at the time of the war with France, and so some of the locals thought that they might be French spies because they would walk along the tops of the cliffs. And and so the Admiralty actually sent someone to investigate the possibility that Dorothy and William and Coleridge were spies. And he came back and said, no, they're just arty people. But their lease wasn't renewed. And so it was at that point that they all decided to go to Germany to try and make their fortune translating German literature into English. And so all three went, but Coleridge ended up in a different part of Germany to Dorothy and William, and it was it wasn't a successful thing. None of them could actually speak German all that well, so the whole translation thing sort of fell apart quite quickly, and they didn't have any money, and it was cold. It was freezing cold that year.
You've got the timeline in the book, and it's threaded through.
Yeah.
So how did you make the decision to form the book that way?
Yeah, it was interesting because I'd done so much research by the time I'd finished writing all the poems that I knew where they were placed and what part of her life I was talking about. But I realised that most people coming to it probably wouldn't have any or much idea of Dorothy's life and the sort of events of her life as opposed to just a poetic rendering of them. So I sort of ummed and ahed about how to do that, whether to have a timeline at the beginning or have one at the end in a sort of index type of thing and have footnotes or whatever. And then quite early on when I was putting the manuscript together, I just thought, oh, well, let's just thread the timeline through the book and see if it works, because some of the things in the timeline aren't in the poems, but there's plenty of things in the poems that aren't in the timelines either. But so it's, for a timeline, it's reasonably rudimentary, but I just thought it was the bare minimum of stuff that people would need to know in order to be able to navigate their way through a book which is, I don't know, it's a bit like a poetic biography, I suppose.
How long did the whole project take?
Well, I did the walk in 2017. I started probably seriously writing the poems in probably 2019. So, a few years. Yep.
That's an interesting aspect of a couple of your books, at least, that they're very researched, but it's more than a historical research. The book, Things I've Thought to Tell You Since I Saw You Last, it's really about the nature of elegy. And I know you wrote the book as part of a dissertation. I sense that entailed a lot of research about the history of elegiac poetry, about the nature of elegy, So can you just describe that?
Yeah, what
did you do?
That was great fun. I was thinking about going and doing a PhD because Paul Hetherington, who ended up being my supervisor, was urging me to go and do one. And my father had died, and a few people close to me had died. And so I was writing a lot of poetry about my father, I suppose, and about friends. But I was also reading a lot of elegiac poetry that had been written by other people. And I started to wonder, look, why does this work? Like, why, when you're sad, would you want to go and read sad poetry? So I started to do some research, and then I thought, look, I'm actually going to make this my research question. Why does it work? So I came up with the theory that elegy is actually, it's a linguistic term called a performative utterance. And a performative utterance is where words actually perform the function to which they refer. So, for instance, if I'm a minister and I'm marrying two people, I hereby pronounce you man and wife. The actual words perform the act.
Speech
acts. Yeah, it's a speech act, yeah. And, you know, another one would be if I owed Kimberly some money and I said, I promise I'll give you that $10 next week. The promise is a speech act. It is the promise. The act of saying it is the promise. It doesn't mean I will give you the $10. I might be lying. Yeah, whereas a minister in a movie who marries someone, that's not a speech act. That's not a performative utterance. So my theory was that elegy performs the act of mourning, and that's why it's effective, because it actually performs the act of mourning to which it refers internally. Anyway, so that was my big theory, and that's what my thesis was about. And because I did a practice-led PhD, which is where you have a creative element and an exegetical element, or a sort of scholarly element, some people do all the research to start with and then write the creative element. Other people start and write the creative element and then go off and do some research. But I actually was bouncing back and forth between them, and it was just the most magical experience of my life, because I would read a scholarly article about elegy or mourning, or, you know, the psychology of mourning, and then I'd think, oh, that'll trigger something, and I'd go and write a poem. Or I would be writing a poem and I'd think, I wonder what psychologists or linguists say about this. And then I would go and do some more research. So they just sort of moved together, the research, the two forms of research, because the poetry is actually, in that sense, a form of research in its own right. Mm. And, yeah, so that book doesn't actually look much like the PhD I did, but it's based on the poetry that I wrote for that PhD.
A very striking thing about it is that the title is Things I've Thought to Tell You Since I Saw You Last. It seems to me that a lot of what is trying to be said is almost ineffable, and there's this quicksilver, foggy element that suffuses this whole book.
Mm. Yes, I think that's right. Do you want me to read the title poem, which is actually the last poem in the book? Things I've Thought to Tell You Since I Saw You Last. How the first sun of summer is a red hand on my shoulder. How cheese can be shattered, corrupted, or bulging from its skin. That I thought I saw you looking from my dog's liquid eye. How, after all, it was only my dog, bone lust and loyalty in dangerous, delicate balance.
Things I've Thought to Tell You Since I Saw You Last, which was from Recent Work Press, was shortlisted for the 2019 Kenneth Slessor Prize and the 2019 ACT Book of the Year, and won the ACT Publishing and Writing Award for Poetry. Penelope Leyland's Nye, also from Recent Work Press, won the 2020 ACT Notable Book Award for Poetry and was shortlisted for the 2021 ACT Book of the Year.
The third book, Beloved, because it has a very specific theme, purpose, it is a departure. How would you characterize your growth, your development, your trajectory as a poet?
I guess I've always written poetry. I had a couple of books published a long, long time ago, and then really didn't write much for about 10 years because I was sort of fairly consumed by work. I had always had fairly demanding jobs, I think you'd say. And the way I feel about it is that I didn't actually give much attention to my writing until, really until I was thinking about retiring from paid work, and going off and doing a PhD was part of that. It was part of pulling back from being available 20 hours a day for work and doing something more for myself, I guess. And so I actually started to take my writing more seriously, not in the sense that I thought it was good, but that I thought I should actually try and make it good.
Mm.
And so I started paying a lot more attention to craft, which I probably didn't do a lot of, you know, things like lineation, and just the simple structure of poems, doing a lot more editing mm-hmm. of my own poetry. And, you know, I look back at the first couple of books I had published years ago, and I just go, no, I'd change that. I mean, every poet is the same. Yeah. You know, once a book's published, it's almost unrecognisable as your own work anymore. Mm. It's sort of, it's gone. But I suppose that doing all the research I did for my PhD, for things I thought to tell you, after I'd finished that, I wrote Nye, which does involve some research. It's, I don't know, pretty apocalyptic poetry, I suppose. A lot of stuff about the environment and so on and so forth. So, but it's not a thematic right. type of volume. But I sort of missed the research, and so when I had the idea for my Dorothy poems, I was so excited to go back to the National Library and sit there and beaver away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit nerdy, isn't it? But no, it's really good fun.
When I was reading Nye, it really struck me as a love letter to the planet, a love letter. First, I was going to say, you know, sort of to the external world, but you know, or nature. But people are in there too. They pop up.
Mm.
So I can see the apocalyptic tendency, but I think it comes from a place of deep love, deep caring.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's right. There's a number of poems in there that were sort of, I set myself a bit of a task to look at something that I wouldn't necessarily think was beautiful or appealing to me and try and write from a different perspective. Like there's a poem in there about carp. I mean, carp in Lake Billy Griffin, you know, they're not exactly the most charming of creatures, but I tried to position myself as a carp and wonder what the life of a carp might be and what might constitute beauty or, yeah, some sense of belonging.
Mm.
And, yeah, so there's a few poems in there that are of that ilk. Mm-hmm. And there's a sequence in there of poems about famous photographs, and from the perspective of the photographer who took the photographs. And again, that's just trying to put yourself in the mindset of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the poems in the book are, yeah, me just playing with an awareness, I suppose, of the world, but not necessarily from my particular perspective of the world. Pobblebonks are, of course, frogs. There's a wonderful place called Yarangabilly where they have it's not far from Canberra, where they have caves and thermal spring, and they've made a swimming pool so you can go and swim. But if you go at the right time of year, you swim with the Pobblebonks. Pobblebonks at Yerangabilly Thermal Spring. The creek emerges kettle hot from its hearthstone to be levied, pool-shaped, quickly cooled by a mouthy winter sky. Ice still numbs those higher streams where galaxias poise inert, clenched to the memory of sun. Here, steam drifts with its promise of warmth, though skin flinches at the very idea. I swim, because to swim I have come. Thickets of tadpoles swarm and veer as one from my trawl net of hair, my wan gargantua, ungainly, ungilled, chilled. Small fry jostle in each of their phases, pinpoint hearts in jellied scum, brief black commas, head-heavy infants, the knee-jerking handless ones, the warty froglets readying, sipping at the dry strangeness of sun. The pool is dammed by a spillway that the strong will grasp and heave upon, dropping into the creek below, to rehearse their heart-pumped, time-stamped, sexy drum, their bonking-sounding banjo.
I love that the poem ends on the word banjo. It could be the only one in the world that does.
It probably is. Probably, certainly the only one that has banjo and popplebonk in it. Well, they're actually called the Eastern Banjo Frog. That's their other name.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Now, another poem from Nye is called During a Blackout. I write this by headlamp, which heightens drama, pushes back dark in white, depthless arcs when I turn my head, which means I turn my head more and more, write less and less, watching instead the indoor phosphor sky of my making and hearing the rubble of air out there hitting things, hearing the ostinato rain. The poem I was going to write, which was about love, coils and sleeps again.
Your ability to take just the right word, which makes just the right sound, and then combine them and then layer image on top of that, I would say that's how poetry works, right? It's a multi-sensory experience.
It is,
yeah. And when you read it, then it's like that third layer. It just all brightens.
Mm.
How much do you read your poems aloud as you're putting them into their final drafts or towards their final drafts?
Always. Yeah. Always.
Over and over.
Yep. Mm. And that is probably one of the things that I do now that I didn't do decades ago when I was first starting out.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually understand that really important aspect of writing poetry, which is hearing it, mm-hmm. hearing the voice. Tabula rasa. 60 harvests until the end of things, until the last centaur folds from the fetlocks beside his dry well, till mermaids shed scales in dulling strips and wallow in the tepid swell. The phoenix cannot gather his scattered kindling in such a wind. The golden apple splits and turns wormy. The sphinx has no riddle for the occasion. The bright poppy, which grows best in soil assaulted by flash flood or blood, was no symbol of rebirth and mourning after all, but a red flag of warning, semaphoring. 60 springs of diminishing returns. Then the last leviathan will lie bloated on the beach. gone Gilgamesh, Bruegel's Babel, all of Beethoven, angels twirling on the bright heads of pins.
On this episode of Poetry on the Radio, and the preceding one, we've spoken with Canberra-based poet Penelope Leyland. Next week, our guest will be Jen Webb, who'll talk about the rewards of poetry that is attuned to the everyday. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, May 22 at 7 p.m, That Poetry Thing at Smith's Alternative presents an open mic evening of mother tongue multilingual poetry. The featured poet is Aka Ballinger Constantine, whose poems move from English to French, Spanish, and Romanian. During the open mic, poets have 4 minutes to share a poem and an introduction or translation. For a spot, email mothertonguemic@gmail.com. Entry to the University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize is open until June 30. The university's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research has announced that the judges this year will be two internationally renowned poets, Tony Barnstone from the United States and Mani Rao from India. The winner will receive $15,000, the runner-up $5,000, and there's also an international entrant award of $5,000. Search online for University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize. That deadline again, June 30. The three poets at the next reading at Manning Clark House in Forest this coming Thursday, May 25 at 7 p.m. are Jennifer Kamar Martinello, Shehzad Hati and Melinda Smith. For information, go to the Facebook page of the Manning Clark House Poetry Series. Congratulations to Queanbeyan-based poet Omar Musa, whose Killer Nova was highly commended in the recently announced ACT Book of the Year Awards. Also highly commended was poet and fiction writer Melina Bobas for her story collection The Kindness of Birds. This year's ACT Book of the Year Award went to novelist Lucy Neave for Believe in Me. Omar Musa, by the way, sat for a portrait by Sarah McCloskey that was a finalist for the recently announced Archibald Prize. Congratulations also to Theodore L., one of two winners of this year's Ann Elder Award, Poetry Australia's prize for first publications. He was honoured for Beginning in Sight, published in 2022 by Recent Work Press. He shared the prize with Melbourne-based Harry Reid for Leave Me Alone from Cordite Books. The judges praised L.'s intricately elusive landscapes of loss, transformation and insight. Theodore L. is an honorary lecturer at the ANU who specializes in Italian literature. Last year he recorded three of his poems for Art Sounds Poetry on the Radio. Here's one of them.
Sun Shower. Late in the year, a lifted blind let in reunions, light beating on the leaves. A likeness had come over the days to forerunners peopled with smaller shadows, as though old friends were coming home to bargain for extensions on the past, make disclosures from before the crowding out of life. Hesitant warmth, in light of words that left their handprints on the mirror. Pressure to tread lightly on the grass spears, barefoot even. There was recovery in the turf, though a soul could best what the drought had not. Then the clouds, encountering errors, thinned away. Not the peace we were preparing for, though perhaps a truce with silence. A noon for me, a keepsake.
Theodore L. Poetry on the Radio is produced on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Artsound FM in Canberra and is heard Sundays at 4:30 p.m, Mondays at 10:30 p.m, and online at artsound.fm. Look under the Programs tab. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monaghan. The music on today's program has been from Australian pianist-composer Gabriella Smart's Chinese Whispers and other contemporary dance music. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.